Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is with Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of writers and artists over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life and the industry, politics, composition, whatever. If you ask me, songwriters are some of the most worldly and intelligent people I've ever come across. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm co-producing this with my friend Joe London, who's nominated for a Grammy this year. He records every interview and makes sure we sound like angels. So if you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In this week's episode, we meet Savin Kotecha. Savin's story is the most unlikely we've come across. I mean, how does an Indian kid from the middle of Texas become the premier top liner in music? Since we did this interview, Savin's had three major records with Ariana Grande. Into You, which was critically acclaimed, Side to Side, which remained number one at Top 40 for 5 weeks, and Every Day, her fourth and newest single off of Dangerous Woman. As we do, let me set the stage. We're in Savin's back house. It's a modern house, the kind you see in Architecture Digest. It's clean. I find that remarkable considering that he has kids eating in the main house 20 feet away. He's clever, savvy, and worldly. And the decor in his office reflects just that. Anyway, here are some characters and updates you'll need to know for this interview. Evan is Evan Bogart. He's a great writer you'll meet in a few weeks. He wrote Halo, etc. E-Man is a producer they work with. Ilya and Ali are two of the best producers in the world, and Johan Carlson is one of my closest co-writers. All three of them, with Savin, have deals with MXM, which is Max Martin's publishing company. Again, Max is the greatest writer of our generation. The Billboard number one songs list literally goes Paul McCartney, John Lennon, and then Max Martin. MXM is the closest thing to the Brill Building that our generation has. If you don't know the Brill Building, look that up. We'll get more into that in the future. A couple other notes. Love Me Like You Do is by Ellie Goulding. I Can't Feel My Face is by The Weeknd. And Zayn's album has come out since this interview. Again, if you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. And check out our Spotify playlist for this episode to hear some of this writer's greatest hits. Without further ado, here is And the Writer Is. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's guest has sold over 200 million songs in an era when most people don't buy records. He broke a boy band in an era where there were no boy bands. He's been nominated for Grammys to Golden Globes and has done it as a, quote, top liner, unquote. From Austin, Texas, this musician is a business mastermind and yet Instagrams mostly pictures of bath toys. And the writer is the industry's favorite Indian American, Savin Kotecha.
Thank you. That was a very nice intro.
Yes, well, you know.
I'm really proud of my bath toy collection.
It's really impressive how many, how that your focus in life is so. First of all, you're obviously a very public songwriter,
yeah.
And the fact that as now that you have a second child, it just gets more baby. I don't friendly feels like the wrong word. There's got to be a word to describe.
Yeah.
It's bath toys.
But you know what it is? It's like at night when I get home and I'm like sitting on, because I sort of like, after I brush my teeth and get ready for bed, I sort of just sit on the floor in the bathroom and like sort of just meditate and like trying to center myself before I go to sleep. Because I found that like I used to have a lot of problems sleeping, just so much shit going through your head all the time.
Sure.
And you know how it is. You're listening to like the same loop of sound sometimes, right, especially after you're writing.
Yeah.
Like, and you can't get it out of your head kind of thing. But I found that like centering myself before I go to sleep and just sort of meditating and, you know, and praying to or whatever, you know, just doing that like helps me like calm myself before I sleep. And so when I do that, there's like a bathtub to the right, and my son, like if I missed his bath time,
yeah,
like he has his bath toys in various positions, and I kind of like social media in a sense that it's also creative,
right?
Because I'm like, I love like humor and stuff, right, like that, and I think that's a part of creativity.
Sure.
So it's kind of fun to just like say something about his bath toys and just it out there as like, you know,
you literally sit in the bathroom and meditate before you go to bed.
Yeah.
Because that's like your quiet space in the house. With
and it's also
children.
Everyone sleeping. You know what I mean? And
When you meditate, it doesn't like, it's not like it's not like you're making noises.
No, I'm just sitting quiet. Like, I'm just sort of sitting Indian style, quiet.
Or just style,
or just
as
style,
you would say.
As I was, yeah, exactly.
I guess just, it's a different, yeah, different kind of Indian. Wait, is that a religious thing to meditate?
No, it's just, I found that it just brings me calm, you know?
Yeah,
and it's like, yeah. I mean, maybe it's not even meditating where I'm just trying to think of nothing. I'm kind of just being grateful and thinking of everything, you know. And
were you always doing that? Peace.
Before I went, probably for a while, but not always. Before I went to, not always like sitting on the floor.
But
I
mean,
life-wise.
I mean, yeah.
I was brought up like Hindu. And so there was always like prayers you would say before bed. And that's just what you are conditioned to do. Like Christians are.
Is it to a deity or is it to?
No, it's about as when you're younger and you sort of fall for that. Like it is because you're told you're supposed to do that to be a good person by your parents, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know. But then when you're older and you start understanding the world and you have more experiences, and I see whatever God is as energy. Whatever, I mean, we define it as energy. I don't think it's a person or a being. I think it's just this thing that unites us all. And like, where do ideas come from? I can't explain it. So the only language I can use is that's what sort of God is. But it's really, to me, like an energy.
Yeah.
It's not a philosophy. It's not stories. It's not mythology. It's not character. It's not, you know, Jesus or Krishna or whatever. It's just whatever this thing is that makes things go.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Of course. I mean, it's weird because I was gonna go into something more like do the dirty pizza than religion, but I kind of like where religion is. Yeah. We'll talk about do the dirty pizza later. But you know, like the fact that you grew up in Austin as an Indian American who then finds his way to Sweden.
Yeah.
Meets a woman in Sweden, marries a Swede.
So not a typical story to meet.
And
a
then
girl in
ends
Sweden.
Up you end up in on as like a TV personality on X Factor in London during like the prime of that.
Yeah.
And now you're in Los Angeles. It's probably the most improbable kind of story. I mean, do you view that path as being a spiritual? Was it destiny that you'd end up here?
I don't know. It's something. It's obviously a lot of hard work, but I can't. That's my thing. Is you can't explain certain things, right? Like why things happen. Like in your life, the things just happened out of coincidence,
right?
Or if it didn't happen, you would have been on a different path, you know?
Right.
And I remember. I mean, I was so desperate to make it when I was. It gave me like OCD at some points, like waiting for. Because I would send out demo tapes. You know, I had a book of music industry addresses, and I would just send out demo tapes. And then you know,
did you have the Yellow Pages of Rock or what?
No, it was a book. I forgot what it was. There was like a music industry class at night school in
Where?
My high school. It was just about the music business. And it was
in
strange.
Austin?
Yeah, it was at, and it was at like a night school that was done at my high school. So after, and I just saw it in like a flyer. But it was a guy that
at like
used
15
to be,
or something.
Yeah, a guy that used to be like an A&R guy like years ago, and he moved to Austin. And
it's good to know that you have a job if you ever move.
Yeah,
back.
Exactly. And it was all like adults, people in their 30s and 40s that were just like Austin, like musicians or trying to be songwriters within the Austin music scene. And I was like, a kid in there, and like, you know. Yeah. But he recommended some book, and I forgot what it was. And it was just like tiny publishers. It wasn't even like the big publishers. Right. Now that I know, you know, it was things like a little publisher in San Francisco.
Right.
Was in a, I mean, nowadays, I'm sure that whole book is out of business.
I have a book called The Yellow Pages of Rock that I got when I moved here in 98. And it had direct lines to everybody in the music industry.
Oh, wow.
And it was a published, it was published, and it was like a $500 book. You know, and some guy gave it to me because it was the year before. And I that's how I got in, too, was like I would call each person, and my roommate's name was Mike Thompson. I said, I'm Mike Thompson from Raw Songs Records, which was like my fake record label. And I have an artist named Ross Golan you have to meet. And I just started cold calling, and I was calling like heads of A&M Records
that's
and
awesome.
Interscope. And because I had their direct lines, and usually go to their assistant, and they would just hang up. And I end up with like some random meetings had. I remember it, like Famous Music, and so many people said, "Sure, we'll meet. You know, we'll put you in with whatever A&R person." And I would just go in, and I would be so nervous because I lied my way in.
Yeah,
and,
that's awesome.
You know, like those books at the time, because it's not like you had the internet. You could just like send an MP3. You had to like bring a CD.
Bring a CD. I mean, I was in like tapes. I'd send tapes. You know, like I still have old tapes at my parents' house. They left the room, like sort of as is, and I still have the rejection letters and all that kind of stuff.
Have you listened back to any of them?
I'm so nervous to.
You have to.
I have some like earlier demos, but past that point when like CDs became
sure,
a thing,
of course,
that I had listened to a few years ago that were just like, oh god. But the I still remember some of the songs.
Sure.
Of that time when I was writing songs in high school. Like,
what was your first song called, do you know?
I forgot the first song. What was it called? Oh, it was called Forever I Love You. That was the song.
I mean, that at least, like, I think my first lyrics were all, was like Steve the Dog. And, you know, like, I didn't understand the idea of writing an emotional song, or like really writing a song. You were already starting from that kind of title, isn't that far off from Love Me Like You Do.
That's true.
No, you know, it is. Yeah, that's true. But it was like, but it's not, you know, it's not that different.
I was always like into, and still am, I love like romantic comedies and those, like, you know, and chick lit. Those are the books I read. And like, and I always, for some reason, had that thing. And, but I was never allowed. I mean, you're an Indian in Texas. You're never going to get a girlfriend unless it's with like another Indian. But you're not even. I couldn't even have a girl call my house like from till I was like 18. Even then, my parents would like grill me. You know,
but
what
how
I mean?
Did you, like how do you get into music at all? I mean, where how do you even have the desire to read any of these?
I don't know. I just was always
listen.
Into like, you know, in Beverly Hills 90210, and it was like Brenda so and Dylan. It wasn't I was like always like in. I don't know why I was like felt emotion in that way. So I always.
Right.
So, and I think because it was so suppressed, I wasn't allowed to like openly feel like do the teenage dating thing or anything like that. I think so it came out the other way. It came out in sort of my fantasies. So at night, you know, I would take out my sister's keyboard and I would just start figuring out chords and start just writing songs. Whatever.
Did you have to hide playing music then in your house?
I think the first... When we first moved to Austin from the D.C. area, I was 14, and we lived in an apartment, and because my parents were trying to find a house, and they ended up building a house or whatever. So during that time, which was like I guess 2 years, we lived in an apartment, and my room was the family room.
Right.
So I didn't have my own bedroom.
Right.
And so I didn't have any privacy as a teenager or anything like that. So I mean, at night, it would be like when everyone's sleeping, and I didn't have to necessarily hide it as like my parents were like, "What are you doing playing the piano?" But there was a point when it became such an obsession where I had to kind of hide that I was doing it. You know, my mom would call the choir teacher. I had a great choir teacher who I credit for everything because he was always encouraging when like the Indian community and my parents, everyone wasn't. And I would skip class and I'd go into the choir room and to the piano rehearsal. Like they had little like soundproof piano rooms.
Right.
Like vocal rooms, and I would sneak in there, and he would see me. He knew I was there, and he would just turn a blind eye, knowing I was skipping class. And my mom would call him and say, you know, Savin's spending too much time, you know, on music. Can you please encourage him to do other things? And he would just humor her and say, yeah, no problem, definitely, you know. And so that kind of thing happened, but it wasn't
Have you
like,
ever told your teacher that?
Oh, yeah. No, I saw him, like, I want to say like 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe it was 4 years because a good friend of mine's mother passed. A good friend of mine from high school's mother passed away. And she was kind of like, from our friend circle, was like the mama bear kind of. Uh-huh. And when she passed away, I went to Austin to the funeral.
Wow.
And there I saw my, but he's sort of like, you know, he's only knows like classical music. Now sure. he's a choir director at St. Edward's University, something in South Austin. So he's not even in that world, you know?
Right. But when you go home, is there a part of you that just wants to sort of show that community, look at what pop music can do for you? Or is there, you know, is there like a redemption? Or do your parents kind of understand now?
They understand that there's success, but they didn't really understand, because they see money and they see where I live and how we live, which is very foreign to them. So that relationship's changed. I was actually just talking to someone about that yesterday.
It's foreign to them because they don't have those resources. Is it foreign to them that they're humans that live like this?
I think that they're, I mean, they were always well. My dad was a pretty high level guy at IBM, but they're, the way they were brought up, and sort of they're Gujarati, and they were brought up, and Gujaratis are usually the cheapest people on the planet. So even if you have money, you still like are cutting coupons because your money is for the next generation and the next generation. Right. So you don't like, and the fact that I don't do that more because of time, it's like, well, no, I just get it. Don't worry about
it.
My mom would spend $100 to save a penny.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like drive to all the different stores and waste all this gas and spend 4 hours just to find something that's $2 cheaper.
Right.
You know, and without the thinking of like, well, maybe you could just.
Right.
Just that but also for us, and as you know, time is income, right? Because the time that we're doing something like for the house or whatever you're doing, that could be spent creating and that creates your income. So I see it that way as well.
You see some of that struggle of time management? Is any of that inspirational in how you write? In like in devoting time, you know, focusing more on the time you do have to write? Because one of our friends, Wendy Goldstein, when she said to me once, she's like, I'm jealous that you wake up every day and you get to write. You get to create an asset.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, and you know.
I wish you said it.
Ross, I'm so jealous. Every day you get to wake up and create an asset.
It's so creepy. It's
I love it. I think so Wendy knows that I do an impression of her now.
No,
I think someone told her.
It's so good. It's incredible. But wait, but you know what I mean? Like it's your time management. If all obstacles time-wise are eliminated, are you really focused 24 hours a day on songwriting? Probably not. You'd fill it with other random things. You know, it's not like nobody can just write
24. I mean, but I do.
7, or can
I
they?
Would say that, like, I mean, I don't write a lot. I don't write a lot of songs compared to like how I used to, but more because of just I think maybe I'm getting old and I don't have the energy.
What does that mean? Like.
I do write in the sense I'm always looking for ideas, and I shut things down a lot, and I don't like, so I don't even go 30% of the way unless I really feel good about it. So that means sometimes 2 songs a month for me, but I get to do that because I'm in that environment that I'm in sort of at MXM, and I'm only working with a few people and we can do that kind of thing. And then obviously a lot of my time is spent helping manage that.
Is your ratio of songs that you write to songs that get cut and released, is obviously that's improved because it's the only way you write less.
Yeah.
You know, plus the songs that you have out now seem to have a better shot at being singles. Are you a better writer now? Is it the access you have from your past catalog? Or I mean, what I think is it's it? How are you able to create?
I would like to think it's because I'm a better writer. I mean, access is, if something's great, it's great. And I one thing I learned from when I was helping A&R stuff and A&Ring stuff myself, like all the myths of politics actually doesn't exist. I think if it's like this, if there's an A song and an A song, and the A song is from a guy that like has had a lot of hits, or you know that they'll deliver the production, you're going to go with that rather than the guy you don't know, for example, because you know delivering a finished record is a big part of it, not just that the song is amazing and you need to make it sound amazing, whoever's producing it, right? But there's too much at stake for you not to try and pick the best song, what you think is the best song, and what the company actually collectively thinks is the best song. There's just too much at stake now, especially nowadays, to pick it because of politics. You know, there are cases of people like pushing, but they're not pushing.
No names.
I think what those people do though is they just create insecurity, because everyone's still insecure because everything is still subjective, right? So all the, when people are like, no, mine has to be the first single, that song sucks. You know, the other song you're thinking about sucks. All it does is just create, sometimes that will work because all you're doing is just creating an insecurity about the other song.
But it's knocking down somebody else's song in order for you to have your shot.
I'm personally against that. I think it's just the best song should win. And I'm against, as you know, I'm against the deals of like, this has to be the first single.
Isn't it hard for you to be, I mean, if you're in that meeting though, if you're going to be talking to a record label about an artist and you know you have a song that you feel like is a hit, you're going to push for that song because that's still your perspective on what the biggest hit is of the bunch.
Yeah, but I don't really know what, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think I know what a hit is, but I've also been wrong so many times. So I'm more scared of being, maybe that's me being in Sweden and being around Swedes too much.
Right.
I'm like more scared of like being losing wrong. Credibility and being wrong.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm assuming early in my career, I probably would have been like, man, my song was a hit, or, you know.
Right.
But I'm also not that aggressive with A&R people. So I've never was like, you're stupid, man. What are you doing? I don't have that personality like with those people. But like,
were you like that? I mean, I'm just trying to go through some of the chronology here. Yeah. If you went from, you know, you're in Austin, you're in this, you take this class in high school and then you end up in Sweden, although I'm not really sure how you end up there.
Oh, that, I'll make the long story really short. I sent out demo tapes, got a few responses here and there. I've sent out hundreds of tapes. Eventually one, there's a funny like Backstreet Boys story, which is I guess for another day, but like eventually a producer in Nashville who I thought was a producer, but was really just a guitar musician, guitarist, sent me a letter saying that I really like this song, and I do a showcase at the Wild Horse Saloon every year, would love you to be a part of that, and there's all these record labels, and at that time I wanted to be an artist. I was super naive and thought I could sing, and I really can't. And so I was like, yeah, you know, awesome. And he was like, yeah, it's $3,000 and you have to give the publishing of the songs you sing there to me. I didn't know anything. So I was like,
okay,
you know, I told my parents and, you know, I beg, borrowed, and steal to get money, and they paid for some of it because they just wanted to shut me up. And went to Nashville, did this thing. A manager at Gold Mountain Management, I don't know if they even still exist at the time, liked what he heard, what he saw, and he goes, like, I have a friend in New York who's a lawyer, a guy named Joe Serling. And he was like, I'll send him some stuff. And every few months I would finally get in touch with them. And Joe was like, okay, whenever you're in New York, just look me up and we can meet. And later that summer...
And wait, how old are you at this point?
I think I'm 17 or 18.
Okay.
Later that summer, I had some relatives from the UK that had got a contract in New York for IT stuff. And so I went to go visit them, my cousin and his wife. And when I was there, I obviously looked up Joe.
Right.
And then he told me to meet him, and he listened to some... And these are shitty demos. These are like pressing record on a tape deck, playing stuff, swapping, playing...
You're playing piano.
Yeah. And then, like, and not quantizing anything.
Right,
it was just
course.
Really. So he was like, you know, I can just hook you up with some meetings. I feel like these are in the ballpark. So he just called, like, people at EMI. I think it was someone named Paul Adams at EMI. Uh-huh. Someone at, is it Paramount Publishing? Paramount
was the thing.
The old BMG, Clyde Lieberman at the old BMG. A few others, and they were just horrible. I mean, the meetings were just like...
Yeah, as bad as they could be.
Listen to, this is what you're competing against. And they were properly like finished demos, except for Clyde Lieberman. He was like, you know what? These melodies are really good.
Oh, cool.
And I've got this young guy named Ben Groff that we just hired in LA. And I need to give him something to develop and see what he could do. Let me send this to him and see what he thinks. But then like months went by, finally Ben got back to me. And in this meantime, I'm just writing songs at home, sending out demo tapes. Then after a while, Ben was like, you know, I think you're ready to sign a publishing deal. And him and Clyde. And it was a point, my dad gave me 2 years to make a living in music. Otherwise, I had to go to college. So it was a point where, like, Danny Strict, when he was back at BMG, had to actually call my father and crazy. Like tell him like, no, it's real, because it was over the 2-year deadline, you know. And Clyde Lieberman had to fly over to Austin and come meet my parents and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
So, yeah. There's,
see, and that's why you respect, and going, the reason why I want to go through the chronology is because yeah. that's why you have so much respect for A&R guys, though. Is
yeah.
If you come into it as a real writer, then the ones you meet are the ones who get real songwriting.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that will help usher your career, and you end up respecting them more. And so you view it more collaboratively, and you don't see it the same.
Yeah, definitely. Your perspective. I mean, look, there's a lot of shit ones out there, and most of them are, you know, most of them are just kids that are hustlers and, you know, manage 10 people and see as a way to get their clients cuts, and they don't really right. understand the difference between something great and something that's just good, I think.
Right.
But it's that thing, you never know. I mean, we've had...
But you inherently, at that point, it's not like you understood song math. You hadn't even been to Sweden. You
no.
didn't know, any, you know, the finishing demos and understanding the quality of a finished song.
No, I just,
were not
yeah.
things you understood at that point, but you inherently at least
I had an instinct, knew. I think, for melody and good choruses yeah. and stuff.
But are you, at that point, learning songwriting from your bedroom, are you listening to...
Oh, it was what, like, you know, it was during the Babyface, Boys to Men time.
Right.
Early
but
Max
you, how do you
Martin
know what a
time.
Verse, pre-chorus, chorus is at that point if you're like,
I think I just understood it.
Just inherently.
Yeah, I just inherently understood it, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was able to listen to songs, and I want to do a song in that sure. style. And that was back when I was able to somewhat program. I was like, using Cakewalk. And
nice.
Like, and I was able to, like, you know, somewhat get an idea down, you know? But... And then I went to Sweden, and that kind of that those skills went away because it was with all these. The first time I met real like songwriters and producers, and
right.
that whole idea of like, oh,
well,
I'm just writing.
Who brings you to Sweden?
So Dan. Clyde and Ben.
Uh-huh.
At the time, there was a company called Merlin. So in Sweden, there was Sharon who did all the
right.
big stuff, and there was a company called Merlin who did basically the stuff that Sharon didn't do or
right.
wouldn't do. Like because Sharon was there were this exclusive bunch signed had an exclusive deal kind of with BMG and Jive, and. And like, or Zomba, sorry. And Merlin, who sort of, who basically was like Anders Bog and a few other people, and they were really good, but they weren't as good as the
right.
Sharon guys. And they basically, like, so if Sharon did Britney Spears, Merlin would do Jessica Simpson, because
right.
Jessica Simpson couldn't get in Sharon. Does
right.
that make sense? And they had a couple hits, like 98
yeah,
Degrees.
Sure.
So Sharon did Backstreet Boys and NSYNC.
They,
and then people would be like, oh, we have this Billboard band, 98 Degrees. Let's send them to Sweden. Because all the American A&Rs
right.
thought it was just the Swedes.
Right.
It didn't matter, you know,
sure.
who it was.
I still think they feel like that.
Yeah, and they don't know,
I don't think A&R guys know the difference between those.
Yeah, especially back then when
Swedes.
Sharon was so exclusive.
Sure.
And the funny thing, the guys that ran Merlin used to actually say, there was an email that accidentally was sent to the guy that co-ran Sharon, years later, where he was trying to get the Merlin guy was trying to get investors, and he said he took credit for a lot of the show. You know, we're
oh,
doing
wow.
to do Backstreet Boys and all this kind of stuff, and it accidentally was CC'd to that guy, and it became this whole problem. But like they were just you know they
sure.
went out and they got like work, and so they were looking for a publisher, an admin publisher, because they were getting some heat on stuff. So they were talking to BMG,
yeah,
and so they were like, oh, you should bring your writers over, and they were like, yeah, we just signed this kid. The deal with them, and I'm not working out, and they went to Universal, I think.
Right.
But that's how I got sent to Sweden. So
how do you switch over then from like one, you know, how do you kind of sneak across Stockholm to the, to...
Well, it took years.
You're 18 at that point?
At that point, I was probably 20, I think. 19 or 20, my first
trip to
Sweden.
So your sort of collegiate years are busy trying to figure out how to get to Sweden, and then
yeah.
you end up in Sweden.
So I kept going back and forth. They kept
right.
sending me, because it would be, I would get like a single in Denmark, and
yeah,
then
yeah.
I would, you know. And it was the first time I made like friends who had any interest in what I do. You know, all my
sure.
friends went off to university. I was kind of like the
right.
loser. I was like volunteering at the middle school, helping, like, they didn't have a choir program there because kids weren't interested.
Right.
And I helped build a choir program at the middle school. But it was just like, you know, I had so much anxiety and embarrassment, you know, going to like the grocery store, running into people's moms you went to high school with.
Right.
And you're like the loser kind of, like, because I was
sort of
known.
Is that more reason why when you go back for, you know, not, I mean, the funeral is a sad time to go, but you go back to home and there's got to be. Everyone knows what you've been doing.
Yeah, it's been good. I mean, not every, because you know how songwriters don't get like, you're not like in the press. I don't do much press at all. So
yeah, but
like,
you're, I mean,
but people know,
Facebook
yeah.
and Instagram and Twitter, and I feel like there's some way that your high school people from
yeah,
your high school
yeah, people
still
know.
Talk about like, hey, you know, that's pretty cool that
yeah.
song was.
No, like my my friends know, and no, that's kind of fun. My friends know, and my, you know, they're the ones I'm still in touch with, and you know, in the whole Indian, I mean, the biggest part of my life at the time was obviously raised in a big Indian community. So the Indian community obviously knows, because just that's there's no one in the Indian community. You know, a lot of the actors are half Indian, and they're not really like, ooh, I'm, you know, they're not, they weren't really raised within a big Indian community.
Right.
So the fact that I was, I think that's a big pride for the community.
Right.
But yeah, so, so that's kind of, but it also gets kind of weird because then it's all about that. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that I kind of get scared when I go back a little bit. I just stay at my parents' house and I'll go with my wife to a movie. They want to have like people over and the whole community to like, we never had a dinner for your engagement. Let's have, you know, but then it doesn't become about engagement. It becomes about like what I do for a living. Does that make sense?
Of course.
So that kind of makes me nervous.
I just had a relative recently come up and be, you know, say, like, so you make good money, don't you?
Yeah,
I just jumped straight to that. I was like,
"Yeah, that happens."
I mean, I haven't
lot.
Seen you in years, bro. Yeah. It's like, I know we're related-ish.
Yeah, no, but that like, the money thing. The money thing's kind of funny. You know, I was talking to a few people yesterday because we were just discussing about a mutual friend, and we were talking about that. It's so funny when that happens. That like. You know, because we don't do it for money. I mean, I was broke eating beans out of a can, you know, for years. So if I would still do that, I'd still do what I'm doing, whether you have money or not, right? But like, I mean, now I have kids. I have to think about that stuff.
Right.
But if it wasn't for the kids, you're kind of thinking you just do it because that's what you love to do. It's so hard to do it and to get a break that there's just many easier ways to make money. You know, if you're going to put the same effort and time in, think about that. What you put the same effort and time in songwriting, if you average it out from when you started and how many hours you've put in, it's probably the wage, the hourly wage is very little. If you think, even if you're pretty successful, like, you know, and you have to also think about like an athlete, right? Like you have a window.
You have 5 years of playing pro football.
And then done. Right. And then when you look at it, a lifespan, it's actually not that much money.
Right.
It just can come in a clunk if you're very successful.
Yeah, and if you're at the very top, you're talking about different money than you are at the bottom.
Well, yeah, there's a difference. I mean, you probably know that now. You definitely will start, if you haven't, with the year you're having and next year, that there's like even a huge difference between like top 20 on radio there's a huge difference between 10 to 5, and there's a huge difference between 5 and 3 on radio. It's a crazy gap. You could think like, oh, I have a like top 15 on radio that I can like, you know, pay my mortgage next year. It's like, no, you can't.
Right.
You know.
I mean, when you started getting into those, because you were in Sweden for 10 years, right?
Something like 13. That? Like 13 years? So, I went back and forth for like 2 years, and then it was actually Red
One.
They
were selling at that point, at least when you were first there. They were albums were still being bought, and you had access to the projects that were selling.
No,
a lot,
it wasn't actually.
Right?
No, I wasn't in. The only people that were really explosively big when I was starting going to Sweden was Sharon, but they were so reclusive. I mean, none of them. They didn't work with any outside people. They became super famous in Sweden. They're very like. They were at the time, no one could get in that circle. I mean, they were working, you know, 18-hour days. They didn't even see the light of day. And when you talk to those guys, they didn't even know they had made money or anything. They didn't even know how successful they were until it was over. And then they walked out of the building. You know, there's a building in a place called Fridhemsplan. And if you ever go to Sweden, you could go see the building because it's now like an indie record label and a studio down below. It's like, you know, they get out and it's like, oh! And it's like, wow. Yeah. We're like famous here. We can go to clubs, and you know, and then they all went and lived their lives because it was a very intense.
And that's
7 to 8
Max
years.
And
Max, Rami,
and Rami and Carl, and all those.
Well, Carl wasn't a part of that. Oh, he was too young. So me and Carl were sort of the same generation. By the time we sort of got our shot and started things happening, that Sharon was way over.
Yeah.
So because it sort of ended after that third Backstreet Boy, the Black and Blue album was sort of the last. Yeah. I think that was the last project.
Why did it end?
I guess there's different theories, but I mean, they all usually will say when Dennis Pop passed away, the fun was done, and you know, and they were doing it for so long and so many, and again, they were people that didn't write a lot of songs. I mean, the songs that they wrote for all those years, they would spend a month on a song. You
but
know?
They had 9 songs on every album. Yeah. Like, how is there aren't enough? There aren't enough months for that to be. I know that people say
there was
that.
There was a group of 8 of them.
Yeah, so I guess that's how that averages out.
And it's not every song took a month, but it was a lot of time.
It's just crazy. I mean, it wasn't even nine.
I think the first Backstreet album wasn't like, it was only like four or five. And then the Britney album was like, what was it? The first Britney album. I think there was like Sometimes, Maybe One More Time. And there was like,
Crazy.
There was probably like five, yeah. You know? And I think they ended up burning themselves out, and then they all wanted to do separate things, work with different people, and they all built their own teams, and that's sort of when I started breaking. Then I slowly, got into some of those teams here and there, and you know, we would have success, especially with in the UK.
Sure.
And then eventually, and everyone in town and the whole community was like, they were like celebrities in the sense of like, ooh, I know someone that knows Andreas Carlson,
right, of course.
Or I know someone that knows someone that knows Christian Lundin, and maybe once in a while you'd run into one of them because you were having lunch with one of their friends, and it would be like this big deal that, oh God, that was Andreas Carlson, you know, or that was Max Martin.
Is it weird to be that guy?
I don't really see myself as that guy.
Yeah,
but I also, because I'm in a bubble, I'm in the same situation. I mean,
now you're in
that
bubble,
this,
right?
Is that we're in this bubble. Right. I never realize how, because especially when you're with sort of a legend like that whose bar is so high. Like, I think this past year we had like, I had 8 songs on Top 10 of radio, and at the end of the year I felt like shit because On My Mind didn't break into top 3.
Right.
You know, and I had a real, or like Focus didn't do well.
Right.
And I was really bummed out.
Yeah.
Because you're in this bubble and the bar is so high that you don't see that, like, wow, what about all the other stuff?
Sure.
You know, so you really like, and it's, and the only way.
So
like,
many of the things I wrote on the things for us to talk about, you're touching on where it's like the idea that I don't see how you can possibly celebrate every success when you have 5 songs on top 40 at any given time. How is there any possibility that you can celebrate the peak of a song?
You don't celebrate
because you're constantly pushing for that next one to beat that last one or match that last one. I mean,
no, there's no sub. I think what happens, and I've been learning now I understand the Sharon thing and the mentality that they had was like, it's just adrenaline because you love what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you're doing it for success, then you're really just celebrating. Then you'll stop and be like, woohoo! And then
you made it, and then you're
And then it passes by because we're in a really interesting business. If you think about it, we're chasing something that we'll never achieve because a hit song, you know,
there's always another hit song.
Hit song lasts. It lasts for like a week or two.
Sure.
You know, if a big one lasts for a few months and then it's done and then there's like 10 other songs that have replaced it and you no longer have a hit song.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well,
it's this constant, like, it's just short period of time. So how do you, I don't understand. And that's what tortures me and keeps me up at night. And I think people that are obsessed with it, and I think most of us are, is that like, what do you, and my wife asks that because she's so out of the music. She doesn't, you know, out of an entertainment business. She has no, like, she doesn't even like it necessarily, you know. She's like, but when's the end game? Or what is the goal
what is
here?
The end game?
But there is, I don't, because, you know, a hit song is a great feeling, but it goes away. And then there's other songs you play. And then when you have a lot of hit songs, you start getting addicted to the feeling of that song.
Of having a song always.
Have a song
at
the
top.
On the radio or whatever. And then when you don't, you actually get in this really dark headspace.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's a weird thing. And it's like, but
that's,
I don't
what
know.
When it, you know, the idea of acting like you've been there before.
Yeah.
I hate that because every time you have a song, another song that's a hit.
Yeah.
You know, it's that song's story.
Yeah.
And there's, in Nashville, I don't care if you've had 10 number one songs that year, every single one, the PRO, you know, BMI or ASCAP, and your publisher is throwing a number one party, and the artist shows up, and everyone goes and celebrates the success of that song. And it just doesn't, in this case, like, I'm yesterday I was with all the people I wrote Same Old Love with, and I hadn't seen a couple of them since we wrote the song.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, congratulations to you too. And then we continued on.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
like
it,
we just continued.
Right?
But it wasn't like, you know, there's, I think people assume that there is like this reward. And the reward is more like, nice, I'm continuing to reach the potential that other people see that I'm supposed to reach.
Yeah. Or that you continue, you're able to do it, that you're able to like do it. Like, that's my thing, you know, like, especially nowadays, to be able to just make a living, be comfortable, and that allowed, because my whole life has now been shaped around allowing me to just write songs.
Sure.
You end up, especially when you start having kids and stuff, you end up, everything that goes on in your life, the conveniences that the money buys you, is sure. only conveniences that then allow you to just focus on writing songs.
Right.
Does that make
right.
sense?
Of course.
So my whole life is built around that. Everything to not, so I don't have to think about other things. I can just go to the studio and write songs because that's the obsession.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
But you've also had a few things this year, going back one thing, like you've had a few things this year that you've never had before where, you know, the
somewhat credibility, I guess.
What was that?
Credibility to a point.
Maybe. I mean, Can't Feel My Face and Love Me Like You Do both got nominated, or what is it? Me Like You Do got a Golden Globe nomination.
It got like the movie thing. Can't Feel My Face is Record of the Year, but they don't give that to Songwriters Record of the Year. Isn't that weird?
I know.
They don't give Songwriters, if you have album of the Year. That one pisses me off.
I agree.
That, like, it's like, come on.
You see, I don't know if you ever see, every year I tweet the same thing.
Oh, really? We should talk to the cat. Are you a governor? I'm like one of those voted, but I never had time to go. That's the other thing. It's like, how do you be an advocate when you don't have time? Because you're trying to, all my time is focused on trying to do better work.
Right.
And it's hard to be an advocate. But that, I mean, Evan's really good with that stuff.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot. I mean, I think
because we can change it. If enough of us goes to those meetings and, hey, this is like messed up. Like, why? Like the guy, no disrespect to mastering guys, but the guy that masters the album gets a Grammy, but the people that actually wrote the songs and some of the lyrics and melodies, you actually don't get a Grammy for an album.
Well, I understand Record of the Year.
Yeah,
I guess, the recording of the song, and I understand Song of the Year because that's the writing of the song. But the minute that producers started getting songwriting credit, it felt weird that when I do all the vocal arrangements, that I'm not part of the production.
Record. Yeah.
And then when you get to Album of the Year, the fact that that is a collection of records, but it's also a collection of songs because the album has, because nobody is releasing covers anymore because there's no incentive. So without being releasing any covers and it's all original content, then that original content should all be included in
definitely.
Album.
And I don't know why they think that that's okay to not do that.
I mean, historically, it makes sense.
Yeah, well, I know, because what you're saying with the covers and stuff
It makes sense why, and it's hard to change it because, I mean, it's a lot of the people who are on the governing board were around in the 60s, 70s. Yeah. And
but there's enough of us now that we could probably make a change if we put the effort in. It's just about having the time, but
we're all
too busy.
With all the other things that we're advocating for as songwriters, it's hard to make that another thing.
I know. You know, but then it's also all for vanity, that part. So I guess it's more important to make sure that the next generation can earn a living than us get trophies.
Sure. Right.
When you put it out that way, it's more important. It goes down the line of priorities.
When you mentioned like having lunch with somebody and how like that's, or even just meeting those people, like that's sort of how we met. And I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I remember we had breakfast at Le Pan.
Yeah, but that's like the first time we have this lunch. And that was like, for me, I'd been getting some cuts.
Yeah.
But at that point, I don't think I had any like reputable singles, and maybe not. I mean, maybe I had a Bieber song and like
you had a Nicki Minaj song.
Yeah, I had like a couple out, but not like anything significant. So at that point, you had already had a lot of hits. Like compared to now, because now you're coming out with 8 hits a year, so it's a different ratio. But I remember you saying things like how significant something like Cher, Lloyd, and One Direction are to a career versus, you know, Britney and Usher, because if you break an artist, how much more valuable that is to a songwriter than if you're part of the pantheon of somebody's catalog.
Yeah. You know? That's why I never, and we've spoken about this before, and I never understood, like, the, you know, when the whole town gets into, like, and I understand why people do it and have to do it anyway, but, like, the focus of, like, when there's, like, a Rihanna album and everyone's writing for Rihanna, right? I was like, you know, we've spoken about this a bunch of times, and I never understood that everyone's chasing that thing. Okay, but then who's doing that other thing? Maybe I should do that other thing because then I have a better shot. And it was actually Max who kind of told me that, you know, early on that when you break an artist, you'll see things change.
Sure.
You know, because, you know, at the time when I had a couple hits with Britney, like, she was going to have hits anyway. You know, Rihanna now, historically, Rihanna's going to have hits anyway, right? Whether you or I write a song for Rihanna, Maroon 5 will have hits anyway.
Right.
Whether you and I, so it's not going to be, you're not going to necessarily move the needle for your career. It's just going to be income and the fact that you wrote a hit. But a lot of times those bands are so defined in what they do and their sound that you're not also going to get other artists going, hey, I want a song like that all the time, right? Because nowadays artists have a lot more power than when I first started. You know, there's a lot more artists are in charge of their careers, you know, like the pop artists.
Right.
It's kind of shifted a little bit more to that.
So you think working with, I mean, I guess when you got in with Ariana and when you got in, even with The Weeknd, considering he had obviously a lot of success, but not as a pop artist.
I mean, Weeknd gave us, Ariana's success is what got us The Weeknd, like, hands down. The fact that we worked with Wendy and then Love Me Harder, which she really pushed to get him on. And then he saw what a real hit felt like to his career. Because they used to think, he had great music before, and he's super talented. But they, you know, I remember the conversations we had with his people. Like, they thought, like, Wicked Games was a big, big hit. But it was, like, 32 on Rhythmic Radio. Right. You know what I mean? And now he obviously knows the difference because the access he has and the way his life has changed. We just saw him yesterday, and, he's the sweetest guy. And the way his life has changed.
Sure.
You know, it's a big difference, but when you break an act, and even though One Direction is not, like, a credible act, but the way the meetings that I had with the industry, because whether or not all the boys recognized the development I did for that band from day one, everyone around it that was in charge of it, they all saw it, and that spread within the industry, and the tremendous success, obviously.
Is that why you pulled away from them, or is it just sort of like...
It was.
People,
I mean,
they grew up and they kind of. They grew up. I think they were because they want to go and try to be more credible.
Yeah,
and
so then, I think like a lot in the very beginning, and I'll take blame for some of the stuff in the very beginning. It was a manufactured boy band. That's what it was. You know, none of it. They weren't all like hustling musicians trying to make it. They were on a TV show, and we purposely. And I was open about that. Like, you're going to hate the music that you do in the beginning.
Right.
Like, I was open about that. You know, you're 17-year-old, 18-year-old boys. You're not supposed to like the music that a boy band does.
Right.
Historically, that's just not how it's going to go. Right. And that's what happened, but it blew up.
Right.
And I think, by album three, not all of them, but there was definitely one or two, or one especially, that was, like, kind of bitter about the fact that, you know...
That they're a boy band.
And he was not the talented one, and he wasn't the singer, and he wasn't the star, and you know which one I'm talking about.
Right.
And he then started having something against me and Rami and Karan against that process, I think. And, you know, maybe we could have been more inviting on the creative process during album two and not been so authoritative. But, you know, what happened was also that I knew them from day one when they would cry on my shoulder when stuff, because I was with them throughout the show and developing them.
Yeah.
No one knew what that thing could be or who could sing lead and what that was. And that was me helping shape that thing. And especially the first record, you know, the label wanted, there was a Stargate, like, Rihanna Reject Dancy song that they were really wanted to do. I was like, no, that can't be the direction.
Yeah.
You know, because they were like my little brothers. I had a lot invested in my time and emotionally in these kids and with their parents and everything.
Because of the show.
Because of the show, you get the UK show is really intense and you become family. It's 3 months.
Yeah.
And I love those kids. I would always pick up the phone if any of them call, even that one that, you know. And I remember even with Julian, you know, I had to convince some of them that you should go in with, you know, he's really good. You should really go in with him, you know. And I think, like, and when they did, I'm really happy for Julian and all that. Because I think what he was able to do, because he came from a different perspective. Like, I came from these are kids from a show and I'll tell you guys what to do because right. I, you know, in the beginning, that's what I had to do.
Right.
And I think for me, it was hard to then see them in a different way. And I think they needed, especially like a few of them needed people to see them in a different way.
Right.
And it's kind of hard for me to see them. It was hard sure. for me to adjust and see them in a different way and be like, yeah, I'll give you musical. Yeah, you have musical credibility to me because I already had a bunch of hits with other people.
Right.
And for me, and you guys didn't know what you were doing in the beginning. So why, for me, in my mind, now when I'm looking back, I'm like, I'm sure my process was like, but of course they don't know what they're doing, what they're saying. Like, they're just right. from a show. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I was, when any- I was wrong to think that way because they're, right. They've grown into, especially some of them have grown into really knowing what they're doing. I mean, Harry's a fantastic yeah. writer.
We did that with Tom. To get Harry and Johan and yeah. I did that song and it was shocking how
he's
good
amazing,
he is.
Yeah.
But these kids but have now that. Been we, working with the best writers and yeah. been on tour with the best artists and yeah. throughout the world. And you know, when you have your developing years, spending those 4 or 5 years listening to amazing writers, if you're open-minded and you yeah. know, these guys all should be really good.
Yeah, I mean, and at the point it was like, you know, and you know, it's also this the social thing where I had a baby during the second album. I couldn't be around hanging and going on tour with them and doing that thing. And right. obviously, you know, if you don't know how it is yet, when you help like start an artist from the beginning and you guys are close, you'll understand when they go on tour, there's a lot of other
sure.
people. They start meeting other artists, meeting other writers, and there's a lot of people that want to go get in there
yeah.
and be in your position, and that happens. So that becomes like this mind fuck. So, but with Harry, it was really interesting because Harry always. From such an album too, you really saw that he's a fucking good writer.
Yeah.
Like we did a song together for the third album, the only thing we did for the third album, and he was just the song Happily, which I'm really proud of, and I think he is as well. That he was it wasn't like that thing where you're like
right.
writing down for the artist. He was fucking great and bringing yeah. ideas and so that was cool to see. But I think what especially with one of the particular members, it was hard to see that person that and take that person the way he wanted to be
right.
seen, I think, and he became the loudest voice of the group. And then there was a point where I just told the label it became sort of unhappy for me to
right.
to feel that like why is he doing that, like, you know, I'm so to me it became this really heartbreaking thing
right.
that I felt like I think he wanted they wanted to move in a different direction, and I felt like I don't want to lose sleep over this, and I really felt like I can't see it in a different way than I've seen it, and that. And so I think they made the right. It was right for both of us, put
right.
it that way, to not continue creatively being.
I mean,
doing that thing because
that gave you time. First of all, cutting out things that are negative as a songwriter
yeah,
is essential.
Yeah,
there's an artist that's out right now as a song that's doing really well worldwide,
yeah.
and I was supposed to executive produce it, and I spent 3 weeks, and it was just a toxic thing
yeah.
to be around.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's like
right?
when you cut it, you have to be able to say that the loss of revenue will be gained in another
exactly.
project, and just having that faith in your
yeah,
talent
and it was,
is
and it was
essential.
Hard. It was hard to let go because it was so big, and they're everywhere. And every time I go to a store, I would see their face, yeah. and it was a little bit heartbreaking. But again, and it's not for everyone. Me and Harry always stayed in touch, and me and
sure.
Zane at the time were always in touch.
Right.
And it was like it was. And that, so some of them is always like this loving relationship. And obviously I brought Harry into our camp,
right.
working with Johan, and you guys started working, and it's just, you guys write great music together. I mean, I'm so proud of him. And I know, I haven't heard Zane's solo stuff, but I've heard it's really
have
good.
Have you tried, have you wanted to work on
no,
their solo stuff, or is it now that sort of that train has sailed? As
I think for any of those boys, if they ever reached out to me
sure.
and wanted help,
yeah.
I would, in a heartbeat, do it.
Yeah.
Just because of loyalty. I wouldn't,
right.
you know, if Zane ever said, look, I need your help, can you come listen to stuff? He doesn't need me, from what I understand. It's really good. And I had one
yeah.
conversation with him about, but I don't think they want to go to me. I don't think, I mean, maybe
right.
Harry's a different thing because we're kind of closer and,
right.
and we'll see what he does if, you know, if all that stuff. But like, I understand, probably until the weekend, I understand why Zane wouldn't think, because they also only know me as the guy that did like, their early stuff, which
right,
you know, is not the stuff that they're proud of, even though they
of
know I did other stuff. I mean, you know, Harry understands that because he understands the music business and he knows.
But the weekend right. gives you a credibility to
yeah.
allow you to. I mean, it opens up such a big door. I mean, like you said, Ariana opened the door for the weekend, and those
yeah.
things are.
And then the whole letting the One Direction thing kind of go was a year of kind of trying to find myself again, and sad because it was super intense few years. And I lost a lot of confidence during that time. And I think it was Max who helped me get out of the funk. But then, yeah, then Ariana sort of walked into my life.
How did Max help you out of the funk?
And
how
just being Ariana like a great mentor, and you know, just I wasn't inspired to write so much, and then I felt what I was writing wasn't any good because you know, also when you come from a success like that, the bar again all of a sudden gets raised, right? So anything
you
do that's not that big
is very difficult.
But I also knew I didn't want to, and I also noticed that at the time that I was seen as like the boy band guy. And right. I didn't want to be seen as that because I knew that I could. Because my natural instincts are actually more like rhythmic pop. I grew up on like the Babyface and all that. That was the music that I love. And it's the music that I listened to. So I wanted a chance also to show people what I could really do.
Sure.
And once I got rid of certain things, and I made some bad decisions, I did a few things that I did because I could, not because I should.
You mean the executive producer stuff? The stuff where like you used one of my songs?
Yeah. But in hindsight, you know, I was listening to all these voices and...
No, but honestly, and look, for that project, and we don't have to mention names, like a lot of people believed in that project.
Yeah.
Everyone was trying to get in on that. Yeah. Like whenever there's the new artist that has a platform, you know, people want to be involved.
Exactly.
It's not like you were doing it alone.
Yeah, but in hindsight, again, hindsight's always 20/20, but I realized why that didn't work, why it wouldn't have worked. And
why do some projects like that work? I mean, when there's all the resources a label puts behind a project.
Maybe just music wasn't good enough. Maybe I just made the wrong decisions and direction. The band didn't really want to do that thing, so it wasn't genuine.
Right.
And
but like you just said, though, One Direction didn't really want to do it.
Yeah, but that was a different thing because they were, at the time, it was a very manufactured, it was, you know, that was going to be packaged and it was like, you know.
Right.
It was a thing, and it was already had so much momentum. The other thing we're talking about, I think, the show wasn't that big.
Right.
The other thing we're talking about.
Right.
And, you know, What Makes You Beautiful was, you know, I didn't recognize it at the time, but now when I hear it here and there, I realize, wow, that was a pretty good song.
Still,
you know?
Great. Yeah.
You know, and you know, funnily enough, it came from a genuine place where the other person's first single, they were trying to make me make a new One Direction with those people.
Right.
So it wasn't really from a genuine place.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, What Makes You Beautiful? I wrote that about my wife.
Right.
So as cheesy pop as that is, it was still from there was heart to it. Where the other thing was trying to find a shtick, you know? I think I've learned now throughout the years that doesn't work. And every once in a while, I forget about that. And I'll be like, oh, but this is so fun. It could be one of those things that becomes a thing.
Right.
And it never works.
No, because that thing has to come from a genuine place. If you're going to hit the Kwan or like.
Exactly. And
whatever,
I've tried many times and failed. Right. And now I've really started learning, okay. Like, every time I catch myself a little bit now when I think I have this funny concept. And would that be funny, you know?
Right.
But I think
there's a fine line between clever and funny.
Exactly.
And it's hard to, you know, I think when you have, you know, it says so much about someone like a Meghan Trainor to have follow-up singles because she comes out with, you know, a single like, you know, All About That Bass when it comes out. If that comes from anything less than the most genuine place, that does not work.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's like, yeah, people can feel it through the song somehow.
Yeah.
But no, it was
so when you jump to Ariana, though, it's like, I mean, it's because that's sort of the next big thing, right?
Yeah.
Between,
so I had like
is there something in between?
No, I had a quiet 2014 was kind of, or hit wise, like 2013 was like a very transition. That was when sort of the end of One Direction for me. I did one thing for one of their albums with Harry.
You had the Bieber single, though.
Yeah, but that was sort of from the year before. So like 2012 was a lot of.
So you're thinking in 2013, you're like,
what
oh,
I was
I'm
doing
a terrible
at the time.
Song.
Yeah, I'm thinking.
I'm a terrible songwriter. The only songs that I have are from last year. And,
yeah, and that, you know that feeling.
Yeah.
And then it took me a while to even feel inspired to write. We had just moved to LA, had the baby, adjusting my family to that.
Sure.
And I was doing way too many meetings. I had management at the time, which I shouldn't have. That was, you know, the typical, you know, overambitious, like going, yeah, you should get a record label. I was offered like label deals and all this kind of stuff. I just said no to my gut, kept saying no. And I was spent like every day in meetings rather than creating.
Right.
And that's one of the things that Max always says, and he's been right about, was always like, you know, he gets all these label offers of like all the time.
Sure.
You can just imagine what Max wanted, right? And all he wants to do is write and produce and do that well. And that's a very Swedish thing. It's like you do one or two things well. In American culture, we get this thing. We want to be sort of greedy and like do things because sure. we can rather than because we should.
Right.
So that year I learned that valuable lesson, do things because you should, not because you can. Like I can get a label deal, but should I?
Right.
I can EP all these projects, but should I? You know,
but you act as a, and this is that balance where you act as an A&R guy in at MXM, you act as a publisher, you yeah. act as a manager. For all these writers, because MXM's, yeah. you know, 15 writers,
yeah.
you know, not including Wolf Cousins yeah. or whatever. But MXM, where you're at, you're involved in so many of the writers' careers. And, you know, everyone gives each other's input on yeah. songs. And there's such a collaborative aspect that it's not like you're not taking on the executive role. You're just doing it in an environment that's,
yeah, and I'm
that's
not,
as
and I'm
controlled
not,
as possible.
Exactly. But I'm not also being paid to do that. That's more out of just like, these are my friends. I believe in people. Yeah. And I want to see good music out there. Like,
right.
you know, with like, for your instance, your sake with Johan Carlson, you know, before we finally got you guys to get, before that happened, you know, we were trying to find him someone that, because he's such a great musician and piano player,
yeah.
you know, that in my head, I think one of my good talents are is kind of, yeah, seeing potential in certain things and see what's missing kind of
sure.
thing. And like, you're the perfect melodic and lyrical sense, especially to match Johan Carlson. It was yeah. like the perfect marriage, I think. Right? Would
yeah.
you agree?
And, yeah, and, I mean, it's,
and your it's strengths so and weaknesses are like, and to find that, like, even though, again, I have no, let's say, financial gain from that, but I love Johan and I believe in what we were, when me and Max and Martin Dodd sat down in the house Max was renting, like on Franklin Avenue, when he said, okay, I think I'm ready to do a publishing company. Will you come in and, you know, let's try and make something great.
Right.
I believed in that idea because I know that the whole, if there's a high bar of quality, people are very collaborative
yeah.
and it's you think things through as well. Like right. don't just do things hook, you know, the writer up with something that doesn't make sense just so that person's busy.
Right.
It's okay if that person's not doing anything for a week. Let's find the right thing.
Right.
I believe in that. And I think when you do it, and you can do it on purpose, then it's just yeah. not by perchance.
It feels like a safe place.
Yeah, I hope so.
But on all levels, I think as a writer, it feels safe because you can take a risk and if it's not right, you move on.
Yeah.
But you don't feel like, you know, it doesn't feel like you get one shot and you're out.
No,
do you know
not
what I mean?
All.
Even like once you're sort of in that community, people are encouraging for you to yeah. continue to write and continue.
No, definitely. Because it's, you know, and then again, this is, I guess, the Swedish thing. And credit to Max and the philosophy, I guess, that Sharon had. Was the thing, obviously, we're a lot more open than Sharon
right.
was, which was really a closed bubble. But like, you know, in watching what everyone else was doing with publishing companies and what other producers and writers are doing and learning from those mistakes.
Sure.
Because it isn't about quantity, it's about quality, especially nowadays, you know.
Right.
And it's about trying to write a hit song or a great song on purpose rather than just spitting it out. And some writers, that's just their process. They have to be able
right.
to do that. And that I totally understand, you know.
But you write from that strategic place. I don't know if there's another writer who has the ability to say, this artist needs this kind of song, and you kind of hear that you're thinking of it from like a tempo, a lyric. You're going through sort of the strategy of what kind of song this artist needs before you even go in and write it. And then I feel like you have the ability to capture that.
Thanks.
And that's I think, probably the most... the most unusual talent you have.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I feel that's probably my big talent. Thank you for saying that.
But it's
that,
like writing from a strategic yeah. aspect, and it's like taking song math to a different level. I guess my question is, so, you know, lyrically, you've always been somebody who writes conversationally.
Yeah.
It's so difficult to make something conversational unique and to make
yeah.
something not seem, you know... to pull that into a song, and you're going into this, you're going to songs as a strategist,
yeah.
and yet you're coming out with a song that, you know, it still somehow, it's conversational, but still pushes that limit. How do you stick with Love Me Like You Do, Lola Love Me Like You Do, Touch Me Like You Do, and how does that work? Because I feel like if anybody else does it, it just doesn't seem, you know.
Just a lot of time. I mean, to give credit, what credit due is when we walked in, me and Max actually walked into Love Me Like You Do when Ali and Ilya had the skeletons of it. So Ilya, not the Touch Me Like You Do, but the Love Me Like You Do thing, was that's what he was singing.
Yeah.
He came in, they had they had that thing as a skeleton. And I think one of my talents in sort of what you're saying is that's why I like to meet artists before I write for them, because I always get my ideas come from movies and visual media and right. reading, and I pretend I'm in that character. And that's why I always say, like, if I ever had to live again, I would want to go into theater, you know, because I feel like I have a knack of getting under the skin of something.
Sure.
And, you know, that was, you know, knowing what the movie was and knowing that I had to have heart, and
right.
this girl that's in love with this guy and has to accept his sort of perversions, you know, and just being so in love, and you just got to accept each other for who you are. And,
yeah.
you know, so when he was singing Love Me Like You, Love Me Like You do in the chorus, you know, I had to make that make sense. But it took a lot of time. We're talking like 2 weeks on one lyric.
Right.
You know, and it's such a simple lyric when you really break it down.
But it's so interesting that takes 2 weeks. Is that, you know, people don't realize.
I mean, it wasn't 24 hours a day, 2 weeks, but it was like shaving off the bat and like keep challenging. And that's our philosophy at MXM. You like continue challenging till the end.
Right.
Is there a way to make this better? Is there a way to make this a little bit more special?
Do you have any songs that you were just like, this is a piece of crap. I can't believe it was so successful. Or where it's like, or is there ever a moment where you're like, it really only took a half hour to write the song, and you're like, yeah, maybe that's it.
Yeah, sometimes. I think some things can come quicker. You know, I don't believe that it has to take 2 weeks. Obviously, it doesn't.
Sure.
But some things are just quicker. You know, I think, like, what can I say as a song? I mean, I take a lot longer, like, lyrically. Because,
right.
like you said, it's hard to do. I think the conversational thing can still have some juicy lines here and there.
Right.
Because that's what takes long to me. I think the melodic thing, we have such talented people around. So when I'm doing a melody, Max can come in and, oh, maybe that should do that. Yeah. And then, or Peter Svensson or vice versa, or I'll come into their room. So luckily we've built this thing where, like, it's pretty, I think melodically is pretty tough to beat, you know? Because there's such good people around. And then lyrically, it's just spending time. I think that I see that as like sort of manual labor lyrically. I mean, it has to come from the heart. So you have to make
it's really
feel
the
way.
Hardest part.
It's really, you know, and I think a strong lyric to me is in pop music is a lyric that doesn't get in the way of the melody.
Right.
But still doesn't bore you.
Right.
You know?
Well, and if you're talking about, you know, the full circle thing from where you started in Austin as a suppressed Indian American, you are probably one of the more sexual lyricists.
Yeah, probably.
You know what I mean? Like, are you living your life through these songs?
Oh, absolutely. My wife sometimes would be like, what the fuck are you saying?
Right.
Like, where does this come from, you know? I don't know. I guess so. It just comes from,
Are your kids allowed to listen to pop music?
Yeah, my son... It's actually funny. Have you met Milo? So he loves pop music. Like, he loves what's on the radio. And I can always tell when something's actually going to work because he's 3 years old. So instinctively, when he wants to hear something again, you know that it has something. And funny enough, like, I really thought Back Together, the Marvin Thing, would work. Like, I think everyone around in the studio thought that would work, right? Yeah. And in hindsight, I was talking to Ali and Max about it. That was the one song over the summer that he didn't want to listen to again.
Interesting.
From, like, you know, Can't Feel My Face to, like, you know, even like Cool for the Summer, he really, for some, there was something about the, like, to his ears that he wanted to hear it again.
Right.
And he would say, and he would like cry because he wouldn't know how to express what song it is. Right. Like, you know, the song, I've been married to you, that song.
Yeah.
What? I don't know what song. And he'd be like, no, that song. And I'm like, what song? I mean, now he can communicate a little bit more.
Sure.
He can say, I can't feel my face when I'm with you. You know? But like, and he'd just hear me. He'd come in the office here when I'm working or going through mixes or, you know, trying to get the lyric right. And he'd just come in and he'd hear. And then sometimes he'd dance around.
Right.
And sometimes he'd just sit and then he'd just leave.
Right.
When he comes in dancing around, he wants to hear a song again. Or if, you know, I get the MP3 of the latest bounce and I'm listening to it in the kitchen because I sometimes want to just see, because my wife isn't a big pop fan.
Right.
So if she likes something, then I know that there's something.
Right.
And I don't ask her. I just wait and see if she says something. And then he now is my thing. Like, he'll say, I really, you know, he'll say, can I hear that again? That song again. And that was a song that I thought he would like because you would think a kid would like. It's a bouncy, fun melody. He never got it.
Right.
He never asked to hear it again.
I would love to spend the next hour and a half talking about things like gun control and Trump and all the world's issues, because I know how political you are about that and how political you are about, you know, especially songwriter rights, and you're an advocate for all kinds of you know, both artists and writers and producers. Yeah. And I'd love to hear more, but I know we don't have a lot of time. And it's like, I think what you get out of that I'm here, I'm obviously doing well as a songwriter, but I'm still asking you questions because whether you realize it or not, you've achieved this level of, you are like those Sharon writers. Look at your.
Nice. I don't see it that way, but thank you.
No, but you really should. Nice. And you guys have developed the Brill Building of 2016. I mean, you are a part of a community that is consistent, and you continue to challenge the music industry as a whole. And you should be so proud of that. And I hope that you take some time to celebrate and at least make sure you have dinner or cheers to you while your kids are in a bathtub, because it's such an accomplishment and so many people are trying to get to where you are, where they can hear multiple songs on the radio. I mean, it's still every other song is something you've been a part of.
But you're somewhere. Feeling that now, especially, right?
Yeah,
that,
I feel
that's pretty great.
I'm fortunate to have enough people still remind me of it. Yeah. I think it gets scary when you get to a point where they just expect you to maintain. People just expect you to have hits.
Yeah,
that's a tough thing.
Scary. That makes you
that makes it harder. Afraid.
That's why, one of the reasons why you know I don't write so many songs.
Right.
Is that you get so afraid. You know, the downside of it, and I'm having that now, is I haven't for a long time. And actually, me and Max were just talking about it. He was like, you should just do that. Because it's been a long time where I've just written to write a song.
Sure.
You know, it's always
It'd
been...
It'd be hard to do, too. You'd have to take some time to do it. You'd have to write a couple shit songs.
Yeah,
to write
and it's scary because you feel like there's this pressure now that everything has to be good. But that in that environment, we feel safe. But, like, I'm going to be doing that, like, this first part of the year.
Good.
You know, once we get... In the between of what we have to... We've already committed to, like, the Ariana and Weekend again, like, is just write. So I'm gonna and there's been a few artists that have contacted Ray and you know part of it's actually I feel really bad a lot of times you're just disappointing people you know I stopped doing so many meetings now from last year because I feel like I've got the guys you know in a good place where they know people and they're building on those relationships so I don't have to be the one always going to meetings because I felt like for a while there you're just saying no every morning you're meeting with Zane Harvey you like them and you like their project or you like the artist but you're just saying no all the time.
But building demand is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
And by leaving town or being busy or being committed, it's a disappointment that they can't have you involved. But the minute that you're available, that door is still open. If you were not busy and you were saying no, that's a different thing.
Yeah. But also, you're not there. So you have to really feel like, and again, this is another Max lesson. You have to really feel like you can deliver. And if you can't, even though you love the artist and you like the idea of delivering for that artist, that just happened to me recently where I kind of suggested something and then I actually had to email and back out of it because I realized like I don't have anything in my head. Like I could go in and just try to write for write's sake, but I'm so afraid of that right now because it's been so far. So I think I have to sort of exercise that muscle a little bit.
Sure.
And then agree to do stuff like that, but if I haven't been under the artist's skin, I don't really get it.
Right.
Like I got what Ariana should do and say, and we're close, so we were able to, you know. And she's just says stuff, and she's now, especially in this next album, involved in stuff, and you could see where she wants to go, like with Dangerous Woman, how that's like the perfect thing because that's where, you know, she wants to be, and she is as she grows into a woman. And but if I have an artist, even if it's a huge artist, I love the idea of giving so and so a hit, and but I feel like I can't deliver. I feel like there's this, they're expecting you to.
Sure,
that's the thing with success. It builds this like pressure. So you either just like go with it, not give a fuck, and if it fails, it fails.
Right.
Or there's two personalities of people that do that, and I really admire those people.
Sure.
But for me, I get like scared, and I'm like, okay, if I don't think I'm really gonna deliver, I don't want to risk disappointing them.
And if you're 25, it's okay if you make a lot of those mistakes and stuff.
Yeah.
But at some point, it starts to get like, well, how big's your window?
Yeah.
you know, you gotta make sure you have to continue to be strategic.
And I'd rather have a few things that explode, and then you know, because it's not fun when something doesn't work,
Well, speaking of things that do work, I think that we'll probably edit in here, Do the Dirty Pizza, which is pretty much right when we first met.
Yeah. Do we know what that sold yet?
I have no idea. Probably,
sold a few thousand, right?
So yeah, I mean,
because Niall from One Direction tweeted it. I love it.
I mean, it was like a genuine, it's a song that you, me, and Evan did that E-Man and Andrew Goldstein produced, and we managed to get all these people to tweet about it, and we got really into it, and it became a worldwide trending song.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it was trending.
It was a worldwide trending song, and it was, just us having fun. So the band was called Hot and Ready.
Yeah.
And the song's called Do the Dirty Pizza.
I'm still disappointed we never got like a sync for that. We should have. I don't think we really ever tried, but we kind of should
try. I don't know
if we did.
I don't know why. It's not like it's no more dated now than it was then.
Should we try? We should get publishers to try.
I'd love to.
Like, imagine like a pizza commercial, the dirty pizza.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to Jeff Sparger, David Silberstein from Mega House Music, and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.